Welcome to the Shelf Shedding Movie Show. I'm your host, Jason Dubray, and welcome to part two of Blind Spots, horror movies from the 20-teens. If you didn't listen to the first part of this episode, I took 19 movies that I had not watched from the three-part episode from Larry Parsons Show Rank and Review, where Lee Beckman, Larry, and I put forward our 30 top horror movies of the 20-teens. So Lee and Larry had several movies which I had not watched, some very prominent ones and some more independent horror films. And so I decided in that epic recording session that for this show, I would put together, watch all the movies and then put together a bit of a rank, again, an homage to Rank and Review of those. In the first episode, I went through 19 down to 11, fairly negative on most of them. I would say two movies. My number 12 exists and number 11, Hellbenders. I was waffling on a little bit. I can confidently say I would give those thumbs up, mild thumbs up reviews. I had some criticisms for them. The 10 that are left here are all thumbs up reviews for me. And then one of the questions was, would any of these movies crack my top 30 if I had seen them beforehand? And I had mentioned in the previous episode that there's likely one that I could make a good case for appearing on my top 30 of the 20-teens list. Start off apologizing to Lee and Larry if they weren't happy with my comments about from the previous episode. I did hear from Lee that he was sad to hear that I didn't like the movie Krampus, but again, it's a subjective thing for sure. And lots of people do love that movie and consider it a little bit of a modern horror classic. Any of the movies I mentioned in part one or part two, I think people should watch them and make up their own mind. Even my least favorite of all of these, VHS 2, which also has a huge cult following. If people like it, more power to them, but it just was not my thing. But what is my thing are the top 10 movies that we're going to be talking about. Some of these movies I watched quite a long time ago. In fact, the night that we recorded, one of the movies that will appear in here is one that Lee, Larry, and I watched that very evening and enjoyed. Very fun movie. We'll get to that in a little bit. I find this list of 10, there's some really fun movies. And then there's some really heavy horror movies. It's kind of between like one extreme or the other there. So I think depending on what you personally like for your horror movie fix, if you are a horror movie fan, then there should be something here for everybody. Number 10 is a heavy one for sure. This came from Larry's list and it's a movie called Lovely Molly from 2011.
Oh, babe, I can't believe you moved back into this house. We should have sold it when Dad died.
It's probably just some neighborhood kids. You gonna be all right, Mrs. Reynolds?
Maybe we shouldn't have moved into this place. Ah! Ah!
He's here! Oh. He's here!
Nobody out
he's
here!
He's right there! Well, he's right there! The door! I don't know what to do. He follows me everywhere.
Who? Mom.
You know who.
I'd recommend a psychiatric consultation.
What if she becomes dangerous?
Control anymore.
It's a psychological horror film directed by Eduardo Sanchez, who had been mentioned in the previous show. The film stars Gretchen Lodge as Molly Reynolds, a newlywed who returns to her long abandoned family home and is soon plagued by disturbing memories and supernatural occurrences. As her grip on reality weakens, her husband Tim, played by Johnny Lewis, and sister Hannah, portrayed by Alexandra Holden, struggle to understand the malevolent forces haunting Molly. The film explores themes of trauma, possession, and psychological unraveling. Yeah, this is very much a trauma-based horror film that can work on a few different levels. It could work as a supernatural horror film for sure if you're taking one reading of it, or purely as a psychological one and seeing somebody who, you know, the trauma connected to a place has affected this poor woman to this point. But then it goes very, very dark towards the end. Just a solid horror movie, not a fun horror movie at all, but very, very well acted for the most part. Again, Eduardo Sanchez likes to use this found footage idea, and that style is employed throughout the film. I did find, you know, and again, probably the budget was a little bit of part of this, but in the cinematography, some of the night scenes were a little bit underlit. But overall, as far as the family dynamic, it seems to work well. You're kind of stuck in a place where, with our main character, Molly, ultimately you have to kind of figure out if you like Molly or you don't like Molly. There's perhaps some criticisms that you could lodge at the husband character, Tim, but the reality, economic reality, is that Tim is having to go off to work, and he's, I believe, a truck driver in the film, and so he has to go for days at a time, and he's leaving Molly alone with all these concerns that maybe that, again, an economic choice to return to this childhood home because it was going to be a cheaper for them to live there, but her living there alone for great chunks of time might not have been a great idea. But again, they don't necessarily know this, and a lot of people have to do what they have to do to survive. So if you can take the heaviness of Lovely Molly, I would say it's well worth people's time. It is true capital H horror, and probably has some real life connections that some people can make. Overall, taking a look at the Eduardo Sanchez offerings here from the 20-teens, this was my favorite one, and I'm happy I got a chance to see it, even though it was a very, very heavy film to watch. Number 9, another heavy one, and another one from Larry's list here. Again, as I said in the previous episode, most of the ones from Larry's list, I had not most of them, but a lot of the movies from Larry's list I had not seen. I had seen more of the movies from Lee's list, but there are a few of Lee's that are going to appear fairly soon here. This is a movie I definitely feel like I should have watched at some point. It's 2011's The Grey.
A job at the end of the world. I work security, protecting men from the dangers they cannot see. There's not a second goes by when I'm not thinking of you in some way.
Going home, guys. Let's keep it moving.
Find food. If we don't move and work now, we'll all freeze to death.
Somebody will find us.
They gotta know that plane went off the radar.
Nobody's gonna find us. Not here. We figure out what way is south and we start walking.
This will be one of those wild stories you tell at a party.
Liz, get up, get up.
Don't move. Stare right back at him.
Get to that tree line. We can better defend ourselves.
Here they go!
Go! Go!
Hold on!
You gotta be kidding me.
We can climb down.
If we're following a river, we got a better chance of finding shelter.
take them on, one at a time. I want to see your face, feel your hands in mine.
Don't stop!
Labeled as a survival thriller, but I would also call it horror because, I mean, it really brings the gore. And I think this got lumped in a little bit with a whole series of Liam Neeson action movies and thrillers over the last, 25 years. He's done a lot of these. But this is quite well realized. Liam Neeson plays John Otway. He's a skilled huntsman, and he's working for an oil drilling team in Alaska. There's a rather horrific plane crash that happens. I mean, it's right up there with the plane crashes in movies like Fearless and Alive and films like that. And they're in the middle of the wilderness. And Otway leads a group of survivors, including characters who are played by actors Frank Grillo, Dermot Mulroney, Dallas Roberts, as they face extreme cold, harsh terrain, and a pack of relentless wolves. And it's established early on that there's a little bit of a history with Liam Neeson's character, John, and hunting and tracking wolves when they get into a populated area and are going to cause some trouble. The men must confront their own fears and mortality in a brutal fight for survival. I'd say, the initial plane crash scene, as I said, is spectacular, very well directed, and the aftermath is strong. They make full use of the winter scenery. It is a cold looking film. You can, if you're from Canada like I am, you can feel the pain of these characters. Again, up there with movies like The Revenant and The Hateful Eight. Cold, cold films. They use their setting well. Liam Neeson has some good notes he plays in here. I mean, he is in an action movie mode, survival action, less like the revenge taken type of a role. He has this absolutely amazing scene after the plane crash where there is a character who is dying, and he talks him through the process of dying and makes it a less scary process. And a really amazing scene. This is kind of, and it seemed to be a running theme throughout my first episode here, and maybe I need to get over it a little bit. That seems like maybe it's an excuse, if I don't connect with characters or I don't like them as much, then I'm having trouble promoting the movie. In this case, I'm promoting the movie for sure, but I did find there are some characters who are just so unlikable that I really didn't care as much if they survived or not. Frank Grillo is one of those. He plays this guy who's kind of fighting Liam Neeson throughout the whole thing, a character named Diaz. He's such a jerk at the beginning. They work very, very hard in the second and third act to try to redeem his character. His character is kind of connected to some of the spiritual themes of the film. You're looking at faith, death, the concept of an afterlife. We have some characters who die, who kind of show up as ghosts, whether that, again, supernatural reading of it versus a psychological one. This is, the situation that they're in. They're imagining these characters. So there are a couple of notes where I'd say Neeson goes a bit over the top. There's one where he's trying to wake up somebody who has died, and he starts madly pounding on the guy's chest, and that just doesn't work. Dermot Mulroney, an actor I like. I'm not sure that this is his greatest role, but he's a welcome presence in the movie. There's a sequence with him and falling down a tree, which he just you feel the pain of these characters, and that's a real strength of the film. At points, the cinematography around river scenes had a little bit of a GoPro type of thing. One sequence where a bunch of characters are stuck later flying down the river. I didn't like the photography for that, but maybe, again, it was a bit of a budget thing. There's less money to do that GoPro type of cinematography. I do like, the climax of the movie. Then towards the end, and the spiritual things become very, very strong there, and that often works for me. As I've said, I'm Martin Scorsese, I think, is the greatest director in the history of film, and he's always working with this concept of God and man and the interactions there, and and some pieces like that. I think some beats read as a touch melodramatic towards the end, but it has a really, really good last moment. If I want to be nitpicky, again, the animal CGI at points doesn't work for me as well, but there's a lot of really kind of freaky stuff in here. There was a question as to whether this is a horror movie or not. Absolutely, it's a horror movie, and it's number 9 on my list. Number 8, another one that I feel like I should have watched beforehand. Both Lee and Larry had this one on their list. Another survival horror movie called The Shallows from 2016.
Want to let you know I made it here. Mom was right. It took forever to find, but it's perfect.
What did you say the name of this place was?
This is paradise.
It takes them 32 seconds.
So it's a survival horror thriller. Directed by Jim Colet-Serra. It stars Blake Lively, an underused and underrated actor. She plays Nancy Adams. She's a medical student who seeks solace surfing on a secluded beach after her mother's death. Her serene escape turns into a nightmare when she is attacked by a great white shark and stranded on a small rock formation. She is just 200 yards from shore. Very, very injured. She's completely alone. And she must use her wits and determination, her skills as a medical student as well, to survive the shark's relentless pursuit and make it back to safety. One thing that's really going for it, Blake Lively, it's almost a one-woman show. There's a few other characters here and there, but she is absolutely terrific in this movie. And this is like kind of the idea of almost like Colin Farrell in Phone Booth or Tom Hanks in Castaway. Type of a role, and I just think she's absolutely fantastic in the movie, and she brings the energy. If that performance wasn't there, The Shallows wouldn't work at all. One thing I run into sometimes with, I think both Lee and Larry, they are shark movies on the whole work really well for them as horror movies. Going back to Jaws, I think Jaws is among their favorite horror movies or favorite movies of all time. I really appreciate Jaws. I'm not saying anything against Jaws, but it's never scared me that much. And these shark movies don't always work. But interestingly enough, there's a few of these movies that are going to be mentioned in this top 10. I do get some entertainment out of them, but the scare factor is a lot less for The Shallows than maybe it should be. Again, I haven't had the benefit of watching The Shallows on the big screen and maybe a big screen would give it a little bit of a different edge. Screenplay has some clunky dialogue kind of in the opening scenes. They use slow motion photography way too much. There's a jump scare involving a dolphin. Again, you know, just these false scares. Sometimes they're in everything. I mean, you should just accept them and stop kind of saying that. It's part of the price of admission, I suppose. Really kind of interesting sequence. Again, just underwater. You see the entire screen fills up with her blood, and she's doing surgery on herself, using what she has with her, and some, you know, again, part of this, you know, previous movie talking about trauma. In this case, it's the grief situation of losing her mother, but then she has some of her mother's items that she is using to try to help her survive. That really works well. There's some predictable beats in there. There's kind of one of those moments where you think, oh, she's about to be rescued, and it leads to false hope. Again, it was, if you look at where they are in the movie, it's too early in the movie for her to be in a situation where she would be rescued. Again, some bad choices, as there are in every movie here, but again, she doesn't know that she's in a horror movie. She knows she's in a bad situation. There's a seagull character. Well, let's call it the equivalent of Wilson the volleyball. There's lots of kind of cutesy dialogue between the two of them. I guess, you know, I accepted that in Castaway, so I won't accept it here. But again, thinking, like, would this seagull hang around as long as it does? And I am going to mention a bad practical effect in a movie I really like from this list later on. But again, the shark is fairly CGI. So that kind of takes a little bit of the scare out of it for me. I guess I ultimately had trouble kind of, you know, I felt frustration, but I didn't feel the danger for Blake Lively and this sidekick seagull that I was supposed to feel. You know, I think I was more entertained by this, and I like this character more than a lot of the characters in The Gray, and that's kind of the difference between the two. The thing I would say with The Gray, I did actually at points feel a fair amount of fear and danger, and also some empathy, as there are some really kind of cold and painful moments in this one. This one, I wasn't kind of feeling that or gaining that as much, but that doesn't diminish Blake Lively's just all-star performance. And married to Ryan Reynolds right now, and he gets to work a lot. She doesn't appear in a whole lot of stuff. I don't know if that's by choice or not. I know she's, you know, they have several kids that they're raising and all that, but I sure miss seeing Blake Lively. I really liked her in Ben Affleck's movie The Town as well. I'd be happy to see her in more films, but it hasn't been happening the last several years there. So maybe at some point she'll kind of come back, and I mean, she can really bring it if she has the right material, and I think she definitely does in the Shallows. Okay, number seven. This is the one that's been the longest amount of time since I watched it, because as I mentioned before, there was one that Larry Lee and I watched the night after we had recorded our episode, three-part episode. So, and it was kind of the perfect movie for that, because it was light and fun. This was from Larry's list. He actually had it in his top 10. So if you want to hear his comments on that, that would be in the third episode of the best of 2010. A movie called Attack the Block from 2011.
That's an alien, bruv, believe it. And I landed in the wrong place, though. You get the wrong place.
Welcome to London, motherfucker.
Well done, lads. He discovered a species hitherto unknown to science.
Believe.
Maybe there was a party at the zoo and a monkey fucked a fish.
Yo, check it.
More.
More what?
Them tings. Lovely fireworks.
Mommy, it's an alien invasion.
Of course it is.
I'm killing them. I'm killing them straight. Let's get tooled up, blood.
Quite sweet, really, aren't they?
Oh, that's different. That ain't even the same thing. That looks triple the size, blood.
Everyone run.
We need to get off the streets.
back in a block.
What kind of alien would invade some shitty council estate in South London?
One that's looking for a fight.
What is that? I'm shitting myself in it, but at the same time, this is sick.
We've got one text left. This is too much madness to explain in one text.
We have to call the police.
You'd be better off calling the Ghostbusters, love.
My name ain't Gavin, it's Mayhem, and he's Probs.
Arthur kills us.
No one is gonna ever call you Mayhem if you keep on acting like such a pussy.
We're going to Ron's weed room.
That's the safest place in the block.
What's Ron's weed room?
It's a big room full of weed, and it's Ron's.
I honestly, I hadn't heard of it until it was mentioned by Larry, and we watched it. It covers a lot of different things. He wanted to have sci-fi in kind of each section of his list. So because of the alien creature, it does have some blood and violence, which we could label it as horror. It's also in the action and comedy realm. Directed by Joe Cornish, and it stars John Boyega, who later was in the most recent Star Wars trilogy, and apparently this is the role that got him that. He plays Moses. He's the leader of a teenage street gang in South London, kind of in their public housing. When their neighborhood is invaded by ferocious alien creatures, Moses and his friends, including characters played by friends Dramay, Leon Jones, and Alex Ishmael, they band together to defend their block because it's their block and they run it. They're this youth gang that runs it, so they need to defend it. Jodie Whittaker plays Sam, a nurse who teams up with the gang for survival after this has happened. As the battle escalates, they discover courage and unity in the face of an extraterrestrial threat. But what makes it kind of humorous is, you know, these boys, when they first encounter this alien and their reaction to it, bit of a lead-in to this violence. But part of the problem is they have killed one of the aliens. And this is a female alien and is kind of the leader. So the rest of the aliens come in and they come in hostile. And there is a lot of gore, a lot of violence, but there's also a lot of fun. It's a movie that has a good energy, doesn't overstay its welcome. I really enjoyed it. It was in the fun category. So I mentioned some fairly heavy horror movies, and there's some more heavy horror movies to come in my top 10 here. But Attack the Block, I think, is a lot of fun. It might be a good kind of gateway to horror film as well. I don't think it's, you know, people who don't like horror movies will be able to cling on to something in this movie. It is very British. The accents are thick, and it's I really enjoy that. And it felt, even though it was a fantastical situation, some things felt very very true to life about these young men and trying to figure out something that's extraordinary happening on their block there. So Attack the Block for me is number 7. Number 6, we're back to heavy horror. This one came from Lee's list. It Comes at Night from 2017.
Answers. Do you have any idea what's going on out there? I'm gonna try and help you and your family.
Hey, I want to thank you again for letting us stay here.
Just gonna run through a few things.
When we go out during the day, we like to stick to groups just for safety.
The red door.
It's the only way in and out of the house. It stays closed and locked all the time.
I have the keys. It's the only set.
Most important thing.
What's he see?
It's okay. Just go inside.
We never go out at night.
The door was already open when you got there.
Yeah.
Then who opened it?
I think they're sick.
Where's your mask on? Nobody's sick here.
Can't trust anyone but family.
You don't get it.
How old are you, Travis?
If you're lying to me, I will kill you.
Psychological horror film directed by Trey Edward Schultz. The movie stars Joel Edgerton as Paul, a man who has secluded his family in a remote house to protect them from a mysterious deadly outbreak. Again, 2017, this is 3 years before the coronavirus pandemic, so little did they know that this premise would probably resonate with a lot more people if more people check this film out. Even though parts of it might be a little bit too close to home and a little bit of a downer, but I really think it's a solid film. His wife, Sarah, played by Carmen Ejigo, and their teenage son, Travis, portrayed by Kelvin Harrison Jr., adhere to strict survival rules. Their fragile peace is disrupted when another desperate family, including Christopher Abbott as Will and Riley Keough, the granddaughter of Elvis Presley, plays Kim, seek refuge with them. There's these rules for this house and things start to kind of go sideways, and there's this paranoia and mistrust that starts to grow as the horrors outside and inside the house threaten their survival. This is a very good, again, I like slow burn horror movies. It is a slow burn, so if you're looking for action from the beginning, you're not necessarily going to get it. You're going to be looking at kind of the rules and the situations and kind of wondering why this family, and particularly Joel Edgerton, is so strict and so humorless with this family, and as you know, on a basic level, not wanting to help other people. And sadly, we kind of see why it wasn't a great idea for him to be helping this other family as the story goes on. It is bleak. It is dark. I would call it capital H horror. For some people, you know, if they're looking for just a good time, watch Attack the Block. But if you like your horror a little bit darker, as I tend to, It Comes at Night works very well. I've not always been a Joel Edgerton fan, but I think he, I mean, this role is good. I don't think it's like an amazing role. It was well within his capabilities to be able to play this character, Paul, and do what he does in the film. And he's very comfortable in the action pieces that happen kind of throughout. Really, really good work. The cast is solid. It's well directed and well put together. Ultimately, it's number six. My top five were all ones that I think were just either the darkness of the horror or the uniqueness of the film usurped it a little bit. Or some of the ones I'm talking about, I had a bit more fun with. But it's a really, really good horror movie, and I think people should check out It Comes at Night if you like this genre. Okay, and to my top five here, number five, this came from Larry's list. And Larry boldly started off by saying that this is the movie that David Lynch's Mulholland Drive should have been. So that was a little bit of a shot at my love of David Lynch and my love of Mulholland Drive. I have room in my heart for Mulholland Drive, but I also have room in my heart for Larry's pick, Starry Eyes from 2014. It's a horror film directed by Kevin Kolsch and Dennis Widmeyer. And it stars Alex So as Sarah Walker, struggling actress desperate to make it in Hollywood. After a series of unsettling auditions for a mysterious production company, Sarah lands the lead role, but the opportunity comes with a terrifying cost. She undergoes a physical and psychological transformation. Her dreams of stardom quickly spiral into an absolute nightmare. Cast also includes Amanda Fuller, Noah Segon, and Fabian Therese. They are all a group of Sarah's friends. They're all like struggling actors and creatives, and they're directors. You know, they're wanting to make independent cinema, and one of them's kind of waiting for one to make the big break. I would say there's kind of some, but probably true to life, adolescent jealousy that happens when one or the other becomes a little bit more successful, and that certainly seems to be the case, and very much gets directed towards Sarah, as it looks like she's going to be making it very big. But her true friends, they start to become very concerned about her drastic changes, her health, her weight, all of that. So there's a lot of stuff about the damage that being a struggling actor and the desperation connected to it and doing anything to get the big break. This is 2014. This is a few years before the Me Too movement and the Harvey Weinstein revelations kind of came out. And there is very much a casting couch, Miramax Weinstein company type of an angle here. You could probably also take a look at a Jeffrey Epstein type of idea, and that there's a female casting director who is bringing Sarah to meet the studio head who has, you know, produced several Oscar-winning films and is very big in the industry. And then there's the obvious offer in there. But besides the inappropriate behavior and the idea of exchanging sex for a role, there really is kind of this idea that you are selling your soul to be able to get fame. And I think, you know, that concept and that idea is in Mulholland Drive as well, but it's done in a very different way. And the film is completely different than Starry Eyes, even though they're both about kind of young, somewhat naive women trying to make it big in Hollywood and in LA and living out their dreams there. So Starry Eyes is very good. It gets very big towards the end, arguably over the top. Some of those friends were very two-dimensional characters. And while they're concerned for health, like most of them do also seem like, okay, they want to use her. Like they either want to use her as a punching bag when she's not doing well and they're doing well, or the one indie director, he wants to direct her and give her this great role. But I think he also is attracted to her and he wants to sleep with her in not much different a way than, you know, this horrible, evil studio executive, Satan type of character that we see there. So there are some interesting complexities in that friendship and in that world of celebrating when people get auditions and chances, or fake celebrating, but also there's the backstabbing and all that goes on. There is a cartoonish level of violence to it. So some of the subject matter is probably not for everybody, for sure. But the violence is out there. When things happen, it just goes, it goes wild, and it's like Tarantino level of violence. It's quite over the top. So it does, like, it's not as it's not a down-to-earth movie either, you know, neither is Mulholland Drive. When it shifted out of kind of the realistic story into the craziness, I'm not sure I was completely bridged into that or ready for it. So I kept kind of going a little bit into my head when it switched gears there in the second half of the film. But I appreciated what they were doing. It was ambitious. It was creative. It's not a paint-by-numbers type of horror film at all. And it has many different readings and many different ideas behind it. And so that's just a little bit the edge that it had over it. It Comes at Night for being in my top five from it. It is really not a movie for everyone, but I thought it was very well realized. Number four, way up in number four. And this, what was interesting about this is, like, later conversations with Lee, and Lee, you know, we all have regrets after we produce these lists. And I think there was a movie that he wished he'd put in there. And he was saying that this movie is one that he thought, well, maybe he should have left off his list. I'm glad he put it on the list, because I'm not sure I would have seen it otherwise. It's way up to number four for me. It's a movie called Beneath.
Hey, guys. Woo! Let's do this.
What are you planning on doing out here?
We're just gonna cross the lake, party, have some fun.
Bad idea.
Is there something about this lake you're not telling us?
Someone gonna tell me what's going on?
We have zero oars. We have a hole in the side of our boat. And then, oh yeah, there's a giant flesh-eating fish. And the only thing that thing knows is that whatever's in the water, it's gonna eat.
Are you volunteering to get in the lake to create a diversion?
This is insane.
We're gonna die if we do nothing.
I think we should vote.
Stay away from me! You're a total psycho.
Go for your life!
Ask her who she's been with on this boat!
It's coming!
One last vote.
No! I am not going back out there! No!
From 2013. So Larry Fessenden was mentioned in the previous episode, and Larry Fessenden is the director. It's a horror thriller, stars David Zavoto as Johnny. He joins a group of high school friends for a day of celebration on a remote lake. We've seen this, young people going out to a lake, and trouble ensues. The group includes Bonnie Dennison as Kitty, Chris Conroy as Matt, Mackenzie Rossman as Deb. They soon find themselves trapped in a small boat with a monstrous man-eating fish lurking below. As tensions rise and survival instincts kick in, friendships unravel, dark secrets emerge, turning their leisurely outing into a desperate fight for survival. So this is where you can call me a hypocrite. These are a group of young people. Some of them are very unlikable. And they're going out to a very predictable situation, which you've seen in a million different movies before. Somehow, Beneath really worked for me. I had so much fun with it, and it has a lot of flaws. The biggest flaw, even though it's practical, and maybe it's because I like that it's practical, this creature, you can tell, is completely made of rubber. It's a rubber creature right out of a 1950s B film. But I think it, you know, it does a good job of balancing the B film quality with the survival situation, and they take it seriously. And we see early on the kind of the flaws in this group of friends, and kind of like in Starry Eyes, where these friends are not truly friends. And like this guy, you know, there's the girl that he is really attracted to, who's with this jerk, that, and they all make fun of him. And it's kind of interesting when we kind of hear what the motivations are behind some of these characters and then the choices that they make when, you know, when it comes down to it, are you going to save yourself or are you going to save your friends? There's some really fascinating choices, and might have only been a day's shoot or a couple days. The late, great Mark Margolis, very famous in a lot of different roles, but in the last several years, Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, he just played just an absolutely fabulous character in that. And he is playing the main character's uncle, Johnny's uncle. And he shows up and he knows that there's a danger in this water and that that Johnny's taking them out and that it's risky. And he's saying, like, are you sure? Like, is this, you know, you probably shouldn't be doing this. This is the warning beforehand. But then he shows up for a very, very powerful scene, which I won't ruin, towards the end of the film. And I had a big smile on my face through the whole thing. And yeah, is it overperforming in this top 19 over some others? Probably. But again, very subjective thing. I mean, would I rewatch Beneath again? Definitely. And again, it's doesn't overstay its welcome. It's quick. It provides exactly what it's supposed to do. And I completely went with it. Is The Shallows better made with this, you know, similar kind of a survival idea? Or The Gray, is The Gray better made? Probably, but they had bigger budgets for sure than Beneath does. And somehow Beneath is the one that I've been thinking about for several months since I saw this. Again, this was maybe the second movie of the 19 that I watched, and it stayed with me this whole time. And for quite a while, it was my favorite. A few films I saw towards the end of the run of watching the 19 moved ahead of it, and probably for good reason. But I really, beyond reason, Larry Fessenden's Beneath is a film that I enjoy. We move on to number three, and number three is also from Lee's list. Lee seems to be showing up in the top five quite a bit. And it's a South African zombie movie called The Dead from 2010.
This is flight engineer Lieutenant Brian Murphy, sole survivor of military evacuation flight Lima, November 260.
Our orders are to be at the roadblocks to stop the spread by shooting the infected. But I left to find my son. Are you bitten?
No, I'm okay.
You're American.
I'm an engineer, a mechanic. I fix things. I'm just trying to survive.
Get out! Get out!
It's not possible to survive on foot. The dead are everywhere.
The war between us is normal. There's a new war. And we have to fight it together.
And I know there's, I haven't watched the sequel, The Dead 2, directed by Howard J. Ford and Jonathan Ford, so brothers. Film stars Rob Freeman as Lieutenant Brian Murphy, an American Air Force engineer, survives a plane crash off the coast of Africa, a really good kind of plane crash sequence at the beginning, only to find himself in a continent overrun by the undead. Struggling to stay alive, he teams up with Sergeant Daniel Dembele, played by Prince David Jose. He's a local soldier searching for his missing son. Very compelling subplot. Together, they navigate the treacherous landscape, facing hordes of zombies and other dangers as they journey towards safety. Start off with a criticism. I don't think Rob Freeman is the best actor, but he looks good in the role. And he's supposed to be, he's kind of our main character in the eyes of the film. But Prince David Osei, he gives a really, really good performance, the better performance in the movie. And it was that character I was kind of clinging on to. I will say during the Freeman's good in the long stretches of silent scenes that happen, has a slow burn effect, which is really good. A lot of zombie movies are all action all the time. This one worked well and is kind of a, as much as a zombie movie can be, a very down-to-earth look at this. I think towards the end, the American soldier turns into like a Terminator-like superhero. This is a criticism I had of the much-loved 28 Days Later, where Cillian Murphy turns into the Terminator completely out of nowhere. This still could see that, you know, this is somebody who is an American soldier and is used to battle. But again, there are things that are completely unbelievable in what has been kind of a grounded zombie movie set in South Africa kind of before that. And I would say that the last scene becomes very melodramatic. And I mean, it's the end is like, okay, bring on the sequel. And again, I haven't seen the sequel yet to see where the story goes after this, but there's so much good in it. It's a really, really entertaining zombie film. You know, I'd be a good double with Train to Busan if you want to take a look at some zombie films that are from outside of the Hollywood system and outside of North America. I think that's where we can, you know, I've been starting to look for, you know, these very famous subgenre where, I mean, people I think have been zombied to death. There's so many zombie movies, but the best of them are still standing up real high these days. And I don't know how many people have seen The Dead. This is one I really did think, you know, I was going to enjoy. And it's one of the ones that lived up to expectations. That wasn't necessarily the case with a lot of the 19 films where I thought, well, that I would be looking at certainly the back third of my top 30 list and think to myself, oh, I probably should have knocked some other movies out for these ones. That really wasn't the case. And even the Dead, as much as I enjoy it, I don't think would have made my top 30 horror movies, but it is really, really good, entertaining. I think people should check it out. The acting of the lead character doesn't spoil the meal, but everything else about it and the style of it works really well. So people should check out 2010's The Dead. Okay, the runner-up, number two, came from Larry's list. And yeah, it was very close to being number one. And it was fairly early on that I saw this one too. And I knew it was so well made. And it just it's one that I need to revisit. I'm still thinking about it. And I don't know if the reason, like, still thinking about it seems to be what held me back for putting it in number one. But my number one, as I'll talk about in a few moments, is another one that I was left still thinking about as well. It's Terrified. It also, its original title, Atarantos.
¿Qué es lo que está pasando, chiquito? ¿Por qué viniste a visitarnos? ¿Qué es lo que te trajo hasta acá?
¿Pero qué es lo que implica todo esto?
Esto implica que nosotros tres vamos a dividirnos en cada una de las casas donde creemos que ocurren los fenómenos paranormales.
Señora, acá las cosas se están poniendo muy difíciles.
Usted puede elegir a no estar aquí.
¿Qué carajo es eso?
No tiene que tener sangre en las manos, no en este lugar. A estos seres les gusta la sangre.
It's an Argentine horror film directed by Demian Rogna. It stars Maxi Guillon as Funes, a police officer investigating a series of strange and violent events in the Buenos Aires neighborhood. Alongside him are Norberto Gonzalo as Yano, a paranormal investigator, and Elvira Neto as Moira Albrecht, a colleague with expertise in the supernatural. They delve deeper into the mystery. They encounter terrifying and inexplicable phenomena that challenge their understanding of reality, leading to a gripping and chilling battle against malevolent forces. Probably don't want to ruin too much about this one, but it's a solid Argentine ghost story. And it does have some incredibly creepy sequences, and it's set in a very residential neighborhood. And we kind of see one scene happen at the beginning, and like, how does that relate to this other scenario where we essentially, one thing we talked about at the start of the show is in the 20 teens, used to be an idea that if kids were in the movie, the kids would not die. We have a kid who's killed brutally towards the beginning of the film. And the reappearance of that kid, I would say, is right up there in creepiness with the return of Gage in the Pet Sematary, the 1989 Pet Sematary adaptation of the Stephen King novel. It's a really interesting movie, and then what happens towards the end and leads to a really interesting last scene where we're left once again. It seems to be a kind of a theme through this top 10 of, you could do a reading of it as a supernatural and all of the stuff that we're seeing is actually happening. You could also do a psychological reading of it. Is this connected to some trauma or something else that's going on? But then there's a lot that cannot necessarily be explained. In its way, it's very cold how it presents the material, but that works really well, I think, for the overall style of Terrified. This is a really, really good horror movie that people should check out. I won't label it as a fun horror movie. Again, this would go on to the end of like the more serious, darker ones. The other thing I tend to mention, again, I think movie fans don't get as riled up about this one, but for people who have some issues with subtitles, then they might not enjoy it. But I think you're really missing out on some opportunities here. Train du Busan has subtitles, and that's one of the great horror movies of the 20 teens and basically of the century. I think looking kind of beyond North American and British borders for horror, that's something that I really need to thank Lee and Larry for, is kind of getting me on looking kind of beyond what the studios release, just to find some different ways to celebrate this genre. It's a rare movie that actually scares me, but to entertain me or to get me thinking, and to make a case for this genre that sometimes gets treated like it's all like dumb violence. Like, there's a lot of really great ideas in the 10 movies that I'm talking about here, and Terrified included is one that if you haven't checked out, you should check out. So as it happens, the last movie I was able to get a hold of ended up being the best. And so let's save the last for best. This came from Lee's list, and it's a 2018 movie, British film called In Fabric.
A purchase on a horizon?
I'm just looking, thank you.
The hesitation in your voice, soon to be an echo in the recesses of the spheres of retail. The dress is your image. Onto what you project through an illusion.
I'm just going on a date. I don't normally wear this kind of thing.
Be bold. Your date will compliment you. I would like you to announce the numbers to your telephone.
01632 960 7 and 7 8 and 8 6 and 6 and stop.
As promised.
Thank you.
You look different.
Oh my God, what's that? That looks nasty.
Maybe just the washing powder.
Well, I hope it isn't catchy.
How's it going, Sheila?
Everything's fine.
What happened to your hand?
Washing machine went bananas.
You who wear me will know me.
What's that supposed to mean?
It's just a cheap bit of mystery.
I think something's wrong with that dress.
Don't tell me you're scared of a dress.
The dog ripped it to pieces.
It's brand spanking new almost.
Such a pretty dress.
Anything nice in the sales?
Just a dress.
It's a British horror comedy. Again, that's a real balance in there. I'd say horror satire is a little bit better because I'm not sure I was laughing a whole lot, but the horror came through, and kind of the absurdity and some of the comments about commercialism really came through. It's directed by Peter Strickland. So Peter Strickland was mentioned in the previous show with Barbarian Sound Studio. A film that I thought would be in this top 10 list, but didn't necessarily work for me as well as In Fabric did, but definitely this is a director to watch. Stars an underrated actor named Marianne Jean-Baptiste. She was had a big break in the mid-90s, 1996, in a Mike Leigh film called Secrets and Lies, where she was a black woman who discovered that her birth mother was white. And if you haven't checked that movie out, I haven't watched it in years. I want to revisit that one sometime. It's fantastic. And she's done a lot of kind of American TV work and has been a working actor for a while, but never kind of got the recognition that she did with Secrets and Lies. And she's really good in Fabric. She plays Sheila, a recently divorced woman who purchases a striking red dress from a mysterious department store. And it took some getting used to because the conversations in this department store are like a different language. They're speaking English, but they're speaking in code. And there's something incredibly fascinating and creepy about this. Gwendolyn Christie, great performance, plays Gwen. Gwendolyn Christie sells the dress to Sheila, and it's a really strange role. I bring up the David Lynch fandom again. This movie reminded me a lot of a David Lynch film, and in particular, this Gwendolyn Christie performance, as well as kind of the main guy who runs this this dress shop. And they've got some really strange TV ads, and it's a hypnotizing type of effect that starts to play out throughout the film. So this dress that Sheila has bought, it carries a deadly curse, and it brings misfortune and horror to anyone who wears it. And then these events happen, and then we start to focus on this other couple played by Hayley Squires and Leo Bill. They portray Babs and Reg Speaks, a couple who are also victim to the dress's sinister influence. Lead starts off with kind of a stag where Reg has to wear this dress because these kind of jerks who are buddies get Reg super drunk and put him in this dress before he's supposed to get married. And then the dress comes home and trouble ensues. Weaves a lot of dark humor, very surreal take on consumerism, some supernatural dread there. There are some elements of criticizing the market system. There's repeated scenes that happen in a bank. Sheila works in the bank and with these bank managers. And also a little bit of this concept of with Reg, who's really, really good at fixing these washing machines and is very technically astute. But there's a bit of a script that he has to talk about. He starts talking about and kind of goes on these rants about these technical issues, which leads to this hypnotic scenes. This is one I'm definitely going to be watching again. I think I'm going to get something different every time I watch this movie. It was fascinating from beginning to end, well acted, well directed. I think might be kind of a thing where for some people, they cling to Barbarian Sound Studio, and that was their type of weird Peter Strickland film. And for others, it might be In Fabric, and there might be people who really like both. But in Fabric was just, it was a revelation to me. It was one I wished I had seen when it first came out, but and it's one that I didn't know anything about until Lee included it on his list. I'm really happy that I have since gone on to watch it. So I did have on my list for the top 30 horror movies a documentary called Catfish, which had, the first time I saw it, it just crept me out so much. And again, had a little bit of a personal connection to that story as it played out there. So I don't regret putting it on my top 30, but if there was a movie of these 19 that would have cracked my top 30, In Fabric definitely would have been the one to do that. And I really, really enjoy that film. And I look forward to revisiting these movies and this list of 10 at some point. And some of them, I think, need rewatching. I do hope that they are enriched by rewatching them and they don't have diminishing returns. Because that can sometimes happen when you make these list shows afterwards. You're thinking about it a little bit and like, okay, well, when I watched it second time or third time, maybe I was too generous with it. In some cases, I can say I can watch something again and say I was too hard on it. Right now, this day that I'm recording, this is the list. So for the benefit of those who didn't listen to the first half, the first episode, I'm going to go through the 19 blind spots from the horror movies of the 20-teens. And again, very subjective list. Most of them I do recommend. But I wouldn't steer people away from checking out any of these movies if you like the genre and you're wanting to see something that maybe you haven't heard of or haven't seen before. So for me, number 19, it was VHS 2. Number 18, Krampus. Number 17, Ganjam, Haunted Asylum. Number 16, We Are Still Here. Number 15, Ghost Stories. Number 14, Barbarian Sound Studio. Number 13, Upgrade. Those are all thumbs down reviews. And the remaining ones are ones that I would give a recommendation to a greater or lesser degree. Number 12, Exists. Number 11, Hellbenders. Number 10, Lovely Molly. Number 9, The Grey. Number 8, The Shallows. Number 7, Attack the Block. Number 6, It Comes at Night. Number 5, Starry Eyes. Number 4, Beneath. Number 3, The Dead. Number 2, Terrified. And my favorite movie of the 19 movies that I had not seen from the three-part 20-teens best of episode on Rank and Review is In Fabric. I want to thank Lee and Larry for, you know, mentioning these movies. Some of them I definitely on my own should have watched. But there were a lot in here that I hadn't heard of until we did that list show. And I really enjoyed my time working with them on that show in an epic weekend in Lee's place in Regina, Saskatchewan, putting that show together. And I'm really happy that besides the three shows for Rank and Review, it's produced two solo shows. And I hope Larry and Lee listen to this. And hopefully they aren't too mad at me about the ones I didn't like, but hopefully they're pleased with the ones that I did promote and did like. And I want to thank them again. And their friendship and their love of movies have been something that I've appreciated for years and years and years. And so Lee and Larry will both appear on this show again sometime in the future. I want to thank them and encourage you to check out Rank and Review. As I mentioned a couple episodes ago, Larry's in a hiatus right now. But 250 episodes for you to check out. If you haven't checked out this great movie podcast yet, please do. Also want to shout out Film Feast. I want to shout out Schlock and Awe. And I want to shout out A Lifetime of Hallmark. All friends of the Shelf Shedding Movie Show. Great independent podcasts that you should check out. And as always, I just want to kind of sign out by saying I hope everybody stays healthy and, you know, is kind to one another. And please continue to support the movies, support horror movies or movies of all genres. And even if you come across a bad movie, a bad movie can lead to a conversation with hopefully the movie fans in your life. Thank you again for listening. And until next time, take care.